Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Diagnosing a Killer. I'm Coel.
And I'm Kenna.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Wow, that's a first. I feel like if you listen to any previous episode, we're like, oh, it's been a thing.
It's a day.
Life. No, things have been going really good, and it's good to see you again. I haven't seen you in a while.
I know. It's and weird.
We're actually in the same room again in our old closet.
Yes.
So it's going to sound nice and crisp for the audio, which is nice.
This is just going to have to be the recording closet forever.
It's just going to have to be because it's just not conducive. Unless your new place has a cool recording closet.
Which I intend to make a little cool recording closet. So
there
we'll see.
Go. Perfect. Yeah. But it's not going to be close. So.
No, it's not.
we're going to live like 25 minutes apart.
Yeah.
That's going to be weird. Because even now that I'm not living at home, I only live like 8 minutes away.
Yeah.
So I'm not far.
Yeah. Well, it's not too far from here. It's probably about 12 minutes.
Oh, so. That's not bad.
Yeah. In okay. fact, I think you're even closer where you're at.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
I haven't looked at the address. Sorry. Oh.
Rude.
I have seen the house, though, and it's very nice.
Oh, thanks.
I'm excited for you.
Me too.
We're doing the damn thing. We're moving up.
I know.
Well, I'm excited to hear your case, and before we get started, I'd just like to give everybody our social media handles. If it's your first time here, welcome. If you're not your first time here, then welcome back. Good to see you all. And you can follow us anywhere at Diagnosing a Killer, with the exception of Twitter, which is, or X, which is at Killer Diagnosis. We have a Venmo, PayPal, Cash App set up, all at Diagnosing a Killer. And you can also reach out to us via email at diagnosingakiller@gmail.com.
Yes.
Finally, we do have that Patreon set up. If you are a current Patreon member, you have to do nothing different. You will still be getting the same content. And if you are not a current Patreon member, we do have two tiers now. We have a tier one that'll get ad-free every episode, and then our tier two will get ad-free every episode with an additional bonus episode each month. And
It's exciting. It's new exciting. Stuff. Holidays coming up and all that, so for sure.
Well, that's all I had. I'm really ready to hear what you have, because I feel like I've been eagerly awaiting who you're covering.
It's given me nightmares.
Oh, no.
Today we're going to be talking about a one Andrew Cunanan.
Okay, it kind of sounds familiar, but I'll have to get a memory jog.
And then just a reminder to our listeners, nothing will sound different on your end. However, we are going to be recording the content warning at the end so that Kenna isn't wise to what we're going to be talking about, but you will hear your content warning right now. Content warning, this episode contains discussions of physical abuse, LGBTQ+ discrimination, torture, and ultimately suicide. If this episode is not for you, we encourage you to check out another one of our episodes. Remember that your mental health comes first, and we love you.
Love you.
Love you.
Bye. Bye.
Andrew Philip Cunanan was born August 31st, 1969, in National City, California, to Filipino-American Modesto, or Pete, as he went by, Dungo Cunanan, an Italian-American mother, Mary Ann Shalachi?
There you go.
Shalachi.
That's interesting, because it kind of threw me off for a second. You said California, and then you said his name is Modesto. Isn't there a city in California called Modesto?
There is.
Modesto?
Oh. Yeah.
Heard that one before.
Never heard that. Modesto was a chief petty officer in the Navy, and Mary was a homemaker taking care of Andrew and his three older siblings. The family was brought up in a very devout Catholic home, and by the time that Andrew was born, Modesto was actually serving overseas in the Vietnam War. Due to this, Modesto, from the beginning, had denied that Andrew was even his child.
Oh God, here we go.
And had accused Mary of cheating on him when the child was conceived, although there has been absolutely no evidence that this was the case.
Projecting he was just
like,
much?
Yeah. He's like, oh, you had this baby while I was gone, therefore you cheated on me.
Huh.
Yeah. I don't know
Even
how long
I've only been gone for 9 months.
Yeah. I left yesterday. Yeah. That baby's not mine. Modesto was known for ruling his home with an iron fist, although not as often to his favorite child, Andrew. It is unclear if he became physically abusive to anyone in the home, but Modesto was known for his short amount of patience, especially with children.
That's a great quality to have in an adult.
I want to have plenty of children, but I don't want anything to do with them.
And I don't like kids.
I don't. Yeah. I don't enjoy children. They have sticky hands.
I mean, they do.
They do.
I'm going to be an almond mom to avoid all that shit because, like, there's no way.
Yeah, and I thought that was interesting, too, that he has these children he doesn't really care for, but if he had to pick one, it would be Andrew. You know, the bastard.
Yeah, right, exactly. It makes no sense. Is he an only, maybe he's the only boy? Did you know what
No, I think siblings? I think he has two brothers and a sister.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. So. Maybe he's special.
I guess he's just the baby prince.
Yeah.
Modesto may have had a hard time connecting with his children, and this may explain why he decided to coddle them with money.
He's like, here, get away.
Yeah. Take this money.
It's $100. Bye.
Andrew would live in the master bedroom of the family home.
What?
Complete with his own bathroom.
Where were the parents?
I don't know.
A regular bedroom?
I guess they just, yeah. Well, Modesto's probably rarely home.
Yeah.
So I guess the mother probably lived in a smaller room.
I think Regina George. Like, it used to be my parents, but I made them trade me.
But I made them switch. The family was well off, given Modesto's successful career in the military. And when he finally came home permanently after his service, he decided to change careers and become a stockbroker. More money. Uh-huh. This allotted the family with even better finances, and in order to appease his children, Modesto gave into a lot of luxuries for his children. The kids attended very expensive private schools and dressed their very best every day. And eventually the family settled in La Jolla, California, and once again Andrew was enrolled in a private Episcopal middle school. Teachers and staff remembered Andrew from his laugh and talkative nature. He seemed to be excited about getting to know others and often used his charisma to gain the attention of others. One thing that is also noticed about Andrew around this time was that he often fabricated stories or would sometimes just outright tell lies. Hmm. This wasn't taken too seriously by teachers or staff at the time, as Andrew was the furthest thing from a troublemaker. He never got in trouble, he never picked fights, he just embellished. Okay. It was also determined around this time that Andrew actually had an IQ of 147.
Wow.
Yes. His brother Christopher would say that by age 10, Andrew had read all of the encyclopedias in the home, often referencing facts that he had read about.
Photographic memory.
Right? Andrew would meet his best friend Liz during his attendance here at the private school, and the two became inseparable. Andrew was, as I mentioned, very charismatic, well-dressed, and there was just something different about him. He seemed to really only connect with his girl classmates, and often Andrew got heat for this. Nevertheless, school was an escape for Andrew, and his home life was only continuing to deteriorate. Andrew's mother became severely depressed after the years of verbal abuse she suffered at the hands of his father, and on most days, she would lay in bed and just sleep or cry.
That's such a horrible feeling, because I know you and I both know that how that feels, and laying in bed only makes it worse, but you can't do anything.
You can't get up.
I'm literally not getting up.
Yeah. This only exacerbated Andrew's lies to his friends at school in order to cover up his home life. This also gave Andrew a sense of comfortability in confiding in some of his friends by the time that he had high school. Andrew would eventually come out to his best friend, Liz, that he was, in fact, gay. Andrew had another side to him that began to develop. He would often, on the weekends, take his newly purchased car by his father bought him a car, down to San Francisco's Castro District, known for its dense gay population. Andrew began to find attraction to older, wealthier men, and would opt to go out on dates with these men who would pay for the evening, essentially.
That sounds like, sorry to interrupt you, but that sounds like, for lack of a better phrase, like kind of daddy issues. Like he's trying to seek the comfort of elder men, but I know that he definitely has a constricted relationship with his father, but it also sounds like that maybe, this is me speculating, have been sexually abused. By an older male. Not his father, but maybe an older male, because I feel like that's another thing that can lead into that. Because he has, as far as I'm concerned, the wealth and the money, all that, financially stable from his dad. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I just feel like that it kind of says to me he might have been searching for something different.
Yeah, I do want to remind the listeners that Modesto isn't home very often.
That's also true.
And he's definitely looking for the connection, whether it be intimate or not. He's looking for a connection with someone who represents his father. So
that's true.
I agree with you about the quote-unquote daddy issues, right? Mm-hmm. That he was lacking that growing up, and he's looking for that again.
Yeah. Okay, that makes more sense. Yeah, I forgot to remember that little detail.
Andrew still maintained his grades regardless of his double life, and he would graduate in 1987. He then enrolled in college, mostly at his father's insistence, and he registered for the University of California, San Diego. However, just the following year, in 1988, it would be found out that Modesto had actually been charged for embezzlement, stealing over $100,000.
Oh my gosh. Can people just be rich and just be rich, like, honorably?
No. That's not possible.
The answer is no.
The answer is no.
I'm going to prove you all wrong.
We solved it here on DAK. Modesto would then pack up and flee to the Philippines, leaving his entire family behind. Furthermore, Modesto would then sell the home out from under his family.
Oh my gosh.
Keeping all the profits.
Yeah. But that's crazy.
Mary and the children would move to a small home, and this did not serve Andrew, who had, up until this point, always appeared rich and wealthy and put together.
And not for nothing, but as a kid growing up, if you know nothing else, you kind of get used to that lifestyle.
Yeah.
So it's got to be a huge impact, being like, oh, I can no longer afford this, or I'm no longer being able to live like this.
Yeah, it's kind of silly to call it a culture shock, but I mean, it's more of like a class shock.
Yeah. And I wanted to just ask really quick, do you think that Modesto fled in order to avoid prosecution for those charges?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's why he went to the Philippines and then, you know, sold the house because, you know, if he were to go to trial for that, that's why I don't ever think he went to trial. I think he was charged with it and then he fled.
Right, because if he would have sold the house, they would have been able to take that money, like, just right back.
Yes.
But if he liquidates his assets, so to speak, then maybe he could get away with it?
Yeah, before he's found guilty, exactly. Yeah, okay. He wants to cash in as much as he possibly can.
For someone that is going into the law field, I need to learn more.
Yeah.
So I'm like, how does that work?
Yes, so Andrew was almost immediately fed up by this downgrade, and he would also pack his bags and tell his mother that he was also moving to the Philippines to be with his father. Hmm. Andrew had always known his father to be well put together, rich, and living an affluent life. So Andrew was completely shocked when he went to the Philippines and found his father was living in squalor. In his mind, it was worse than what his mother was living in, so Andrew decided to pack up and leave the Philippines, moving back in with his mother.
He's like, as a matter of fact, make that a round trip. Thank you.
Thank you.
But where's the money for the house? Like, how he's not using that money in the Philippines to give himself that kind of lifestyle there?
I have no idea. And that's another thing, is he paying for his own room and board? Was the money that he got for the house the only money he had?
Yeah, that's true.
And he's got to stretch it out, right? I mean, he's on the run. This entire situation was a lot for Andrew, and thus he began to turn to other things to make himself feel a little better. He began frequenting gay nightclubs, doing drugs, partying all night, hooking up with one-night stands, and eventually coming back home in the wee morning hours.
Jeez.
Mary and Andrew would regularly argue about Andrew's behavior, as she was a devout Catholic woman, and even if she didn't agree with Andrew's being gay, she certainly didn't agree with Andrew putting himself in harm's way.
Right.
Not respecting his body, and overall dangerous situations.
It seems like, I mean, he's kind of looking, yeah, you're right, like, for that outlet. Like, how am I gonna kind of avoid what I feel internally, and I'm gonna just distract myself with all these things?
Yeah, absolutely. Andrew didn't care what his mom had to say. He was gonna do whatever he wanted to do. She was just gonna have to deal with it. They would argue over and over again. One time, Andrew actually would shove his mother, and when she fell, she dislocated her shoulder.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Andrew was completely unapologetic about his behavior. He was dating closeted wealthy men at this time who usually paid for his dinners, his partying, and even his tuition.
Oh, wow.
He had absolutely no plans on changing his path anytime soon. Showing clear signs of a lack of empathy, after this altercation with his mother, Andrew moved closer to the Castro District and would eventually quit school. Although Andrew went on plenty of dates, he did seem to want something long-term. Andrew would continue seeking attention from rich men, and always saw himself as deserving of luxury brand clothing and accessories, and always tried to maintain an overall wealthy image.
Again, if that's all you know growing up, mm-hmm. that's what you're going to want to seek in the future. Yeah. And, you know, I understand that his parents raised him with the mindset of being a hard worker,
mm-hmm.
but I feel like he's kind of like, at this point, fuck it. Like, I've been given money my whole life. Why can't it continue without me doing much for it?
Yeah.
You know, like, work-wise.
Right. Andrew seemed to mostly be driven by this want or wish to look wealthy, but it always seemed like a really profound loss for whenever Andrew would end a relationship. It was especially egregious when it came to being denied by men who refused to reveal that they were even in fact gay. So again, closeted men. He was dating closeted men. And relationships would end, but he would be even more upset if it was out of the refusal of acknowledging that the other person was gay.
Oh my gosh.
So they would be dating in secret, but if the other man chose to end the relationship because he didn't want to be outed,
yeah.
that was especially hurtful to Andrew.
Yeah, he's probably like, I'm living my authentic life. Like, why, you know, why can't you? And that's yeah. that's got to be frustrating. Not to say that anybody should come out before they're ready, but
right.
it's a hard situation.
Liz, Andrew's best friend and her boyfriend, lived with Andrew for a while and would, on more than a few occasions, have to pick up the pieces for a heartbroken Andrew. Andrew's best male friend at the time was a one Jeffrey Trail, and Liz and Jeffrey were always Andrew's sense of community. Andrew's wild behavior continued to escalate, and he began to engage in more risky sexual behaviors with others. He would sometimes not use protection with strangers, and also began exploring the world of kinks. Andrew had begun to watch extreme and violent porn and would enact some of these images with others participating in BDSM groups.
Oh, wow.
During this time, Andrew began to go by different aliases, including Andrew De Silva, Lieutenant Commander Andy Cummings, which is hilarious.
That's so funny.
Also gross.
Super clever.
Drew Cunningham and Kurt Matthew Damaris.
I think Lieutenant Commander Andy Cummings is probably what I'm going to change my Instagram handle to.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
It's brilliant.
In 1995, Andrew began dating a wealthy architect by the name of David Madsen. The two met in a San Fran bar, and David was actually just visiting from Minneapolis at the time. David was in San Francisco, perhaps due to his work on AIDS and HIV awareness. David had recently designed a memorial for the HIV and AIDS epidemic that had eradicated so many lives in the queer community during this time, in the 80s and the 90s. A lot was still not known about this disease, and David was very passionate about educating others surrounding this mysterious illness.
If you want great tasting meals daily, but can't find the time to shop or even cook, we have the solution for you. Fresh Meal Plan is a convenient, easy way to create custom meals delivered right to your door. With hundreds of rotating meals each week, there's always something new to look forward to. Many of their meals are ready in 3 minutes or less, so you don't have to spend all night cooking. Just select your meals, heat, eat, and bon appetit. Click the link in our show notes today for an exclusive offer with Fresh Meal Plan and create the perfect menu for you.
Andrew found immediate attraction to David. He was intelligent, kind, funny, and most of all, he was wealthy. Mm-hmm. Andrew charmed David, and the two kept in contact after their meeting. The two began a long-distance relationship, visiting each other when they could. Things seemed to go well in Andrew's mind, so it was a surprise to him when David would eventually break things off without an explanation. Although, David would tell his friends and family that there was just something off about Andrew that he couldn't quite put his finger on.
I don't know, something about that guy.
Something about that guy. Andrew was, of course, devastated. He didn't understand why David wouldn't want to be with him when he loved him so hard. He tried to make it work, even if it was long distance. Andrew considered David the love of his life, even if their time together was just brief. Once again, Liz and Jeffrey came to Andrew's side to help him through this difficult time. However, Andrew would very soon start dating another man by the name of Norman Blatchford. The two would quickly move in together.
Oh.
This is before gay marriage was legal. They couldn't have. Right. Andrew found himself having full access to Norman's finances.
Ooh.
Norman took Andrew on lavish trips. He bought Andrew a new car. He paid for his way as far as living expenses, dinners, clothing, everything. Mm-hmm. Without a need for having to pay for anything for himself, Andrew began using drugs heavily again. His preferred choice being methamphetamine.
Oh, wow. Super which addictive.
Makes everything better.
Right. That's going to calm him down for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. His already erratic behavior. Mm-hmm. It's great. Regardless of Norman paying for literally everything, Norman would still come to discover that every single one of his credit cards were completely maxed out.
Oh, my gosh.
After this discovery, Norman would bring this up to Andrew, who then responded by packing up his shit and leaving. He was just like, oh, you're going to confront me about taking all your money? I'm gone.
It's like, well, I already took all your money, so what else do you have to offer me?
Yeah, you don't have anything else.
Terrible.
I'm taking this apple you left on the counter.
And the car you bought me.
And the car, right? Even the roast beast.
The roast beast.
The roast beast. Once again, Liz and Jeffrey going to Andrew, help him through this difficult time.
I'm a little worried for Liz and Jeffrey at this moment.
At this point, Jeffrey begins to get fed up with Andrew's behavior. Jeffrey could not understand or see how Andrew would just get, like, just use these men, essentially, who mm-hmm. seem like great guys, and simply leave them or not take any accountability for his actions of the deterioration of the relationship.
Right. He's like, oh, well, he's an asshole. He left me and, you know, whatever. Screw him.
Oh, I'm devastated that I had to leave Norman because he's broke.
Yeah.
Like, what?
He doesn't have any more money. I don't know what the hell happened. But...
what's going to happen to me now?
Yeah.
What about me and my needs?
True narcissistic mm-hmm. tendencies.
Jeffrey was absolutely done. He broke off any relationship with Andrew he had after the breakup with Norman, and he would actually move to Minneapolis, which is coincidentally very close to Andrew's ex,
yikes.
David.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
After this breakup, Andrew actually began dealing drugs as well.
Mm.
It might have been the drug use, or it might have been the multiple breakups, or it may have even been the paranoia that he himself had contracted HIV, but it was clear that Andrew began to develop a deep self-hatred for gay men.
Whoa.
Yeah. In April of 1997, Andrew told a few friends that he was to soon visit Minneapolis to meet up with Jeffrey. People found this to be very odd, as it was a well-known fact that Jeffrey and Andrew, not long ago, had stopped talking.
Now, is Jeffrey a gay man as well?
Yes.
Okay. And Andrew would have been, what, in his late 20s around this point?
I'm not sure. Yeah, so he was born in 69, and this is 97.
Okay. By the way, that was a quote, if anyone didn't get that. One of my favorite movies of all time.
When pushed about if Andrew and Jeff had made up somehow, Andrew would simply state that he and Jeff had, quote, some business to take care of, end quote.
Your little business.
Yeah. It's called meth. I'm kidding. In Minneapolis, Jeff would tell friends that he, in fact, knew that Andrew was coming to visit him, but that he didn't necessarily want to make things right with Andrew.
Because he was dating David.
No! Just that he was willing to hear Andrew out. It was also understood that Andrew was to visit his ex, David, with the intention of rekindling their relationship.
Mm.
Although David made it very clear to others that he was uninterested in making up with Andrew.
Right, it's like you leave someone for a reason.
Yeah.
I don't want them to come trying to find me. Like, bye. Like, we had a good run of it, but, like, I don't want anything
we
to
broke
do
up.
With you.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And we live in different states, so why are you coming all the way over here?
Various reports conflicted on whether or not David and Jeff were in some kind of a romantic relationship, or if Andrew even suspected that the two might be seeing each other.
Mm-hmm.
Correspondence between Jeff and Andrew's best friend Liz suggested that Jeffrey was uncomfortable with Andrew's impending visit, saying that he knew that a big fight or a blow-up was imminent.
Mm-hmm.
The night before Andrew left, he joined a few friends at a ritzy dinner, but unlike usual, Andrew did not pay for the entirety of the dinner. The following day, Andrew headed to Minneapolis and had convinced David to let Andrew stay with him.
What?
David had also suggested that he pay for dinner the first night that Andrew would be in town. Now, the dinner and the stay with David may have only happened because David understood that Andrew was dead broke. He had maxed out all of his credit cards, and in fact, he had asked for an extension on his payment to his credit cards just to pay for the one-way flight to Minneapolis.
One way, you say?
One way. The night that Andrew arrived, David, Jeffrey, and Jeffrey's partner, and Andrew, of course, all visited Jeff's place before David and Andrew went out to an expensive dinner that David would eventually pay for. After dinner, the two, being Andrew and David, would go to a party at a nightclub. The two would return home seemingly without incident that evening. On the 26th of April, Andrew had made plans to stay at Jeffrey's place. However, Jeffrey and his then-boyfriend weren't going to be home, which is possibly why Jeffrey agreed to Andrew staying in the apartment.
Okay.
He's like, yeah, you can stay at our place. We're actually going to be out of town. So if David needs a little space or whatever, maybe David said you can stay here but only one night. Whatever the situation was. Like a house sitter.
Yeah.
Andrew also hoped that Jeff and him eventually would have their long-awaited conversation. When Jeff and his boyfriend returned home the next evening, however, it was odd that none of Andrew's luggage was there. In fact, it almost looked like Andrew had never stayed there. Upon returning home, Jeff would also receive a phone call from Andrew, stating that he was at David's place, and that the first night that Andrew was visiting with Jeff and Jeff's partner, Andrew had actually stolen a handgun from Jeffrey's residence.
What?
So essentially, Andrew's at David's.
Yeah.
And Andrew calls Jeffrey's place and says, hey, we still need to have that long-awaited talk. Oh, and by the way, I stole something from your apartment. It was a gun. If you want it, come over to David's so that I can give you your gun back and we can have this long-awaited conversation.
So while they were out of town, Jeffrey and his partner, Andrew didn't stay over there, but he went over there.
Yes. Well, okay. The first night they were all at Jeff's.
Oh, got it. Got it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So then it's like, so it's almost either like,
He's
using
it
as collateral to like, or an incentive to get Jeffrey over there.
Yes.
Or he's luring Jeffrey over there, maybe for some other sinister reason.
Yeah.
And which I don't still know. I'd be like, ooh, I don't know.
I don't know what Andrew sold him. It could have been like, oh, I took the gun from your apartment because I didn't know how hostile everyone was going to be. I didn't know, like, I'm in Minneapolis. I've never been here before or whatever. You know, I need protection.
Maybe it didn't sound threatening the way he said it.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. It couldn't have, It probably hadn't have been, just because Jeffrey was saying that he didn't want to be around Andrew.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that Andrew, again, using that charisma he's always had, was able to convince Jeffrey to come over.
Yeah.
To David's. Jeff then tells his boyfriend that he's going to go to David's to finally get this chat over with Andrew, but he was not necessarily concerned that Andrew would harm him.
And he's probably thinking, too, like, David's there, like, there's another person there.
Why would he? Jeffrey walked out the door at 9 p.m., arriving at David's apartment around 9:45. When Jeff arrived at David's apartment, he was even more, of course, like you said, at ease that David was at least there. So again, this is now Jeffrey and David and Andrew all at David's apartment. But eventually, David would take the dog for a walk. During this time, Andrew would actually bludgeon Jeffrey with a hammer while David was gone.
Oh my gosh.
Andrew killed Jeffrey, with David returning home a short time later to find Jeffrey's bloodied body on the floor of his apartment.
That's crazy.
Andrew would eventually roll up Jeffrey's body into the living room carpet.
While David's there?
Andrew and David would stay in the apartment for 2 days with Jeffrey's body.
Whoa.
It is not sure what has transpired over the course of these days, but it is confirmed that on at least one occasion, the pair was seen getting onto the elevator at the apartments, and on another occasion, the two were seen walking David's dog.
Just a quick side note, in my mind, I'm thinking now, like, either David's in on this, or he's also under threat of Andrew, and he's now being essentially held hostage and forced to stay there, and he's too afraid to try to run because of what he saw happen to Jeffrey.
Yeah, of course. I mean, again, you're saying you're under the threat of a gun at all times.
Yeah.
Who knows what that's like?
Right.
Do you walk the dog? The entire time, David's dog has to be walked. They have to go on about their business as usual, at least maybe in Andrew's mind.
To save face.
Does he have a gun in his pocket the whole time?
Yeah.
You know? Nobody knows.
Yeah.
On May 3rd, 1997, Andrew presumably forced David to get into his vehicle, and the two began driving into David's vehicle. The vehicle came to a rest at Rush Lake, Minnesota, where David would see an opportunity to escape from Andrew. David turned away to run when Andrew shot David in the back, then knocking him to the ground. Andrew would turn David over before shooting him in the head, killing him by the lake shore.
Oh my God.
Andrew Cunanan had made the decision to head far away from this scene, but not return to California. On May 3rd, which was later that day, Cunanan found himself in Chicago, Illinois, and meanwhile, police had already discovered David's body. Returning to David's home some 3 hours' drive away, Jeffrey's body was also discovered by police.
Oh my God.
Police, who may have thought that maybe David had been the one to hurt Jeffrey and then somehow shot himself, realized very quickly that there was no gun at the scene. They had also realized that David's Jeep was missing, and police put a bolo out, which is a be on the lookout. So they're looking for a red Jeep and a potential suspect. Very quickly, police realized that their potential suspect was Andrew Cunanan after interviewing neighbors and friends.
And like, Jeffrey's boyfriend.
And Jeffrey, yeah, probably, yeah. It was very, very quick. They realized what was going on.
Yeah.
Cunanan, needing to switch vehicles and being without any money, would break into the home of a 72-year-old man by the name of Lee Miglin. Lee was a well-known real estate developer in Chicago and found his fortune in some of the tallest buildings in the U.S. He was also making plans to develop the tallest building in the world.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Lee was known for his philanthropy and was perhaps even more well-known for his love of helping others. However, on this day, Lee was forced to face his mortality. Cunanan bound Lee by his wrists and ankles. Cunanan would then beat the 72-year-old over the course of many hours. It seemed that, for whatever reason, Cunanan looked to torture the man, not just kill him. The FBI would note that duct tape had been wrapped around Lee's face, but that the tape was placed beneath Lee's nose, allowing him to breathe. So it wasn't that he was trying to suffocate him.
Mm-hmm.
Showing that Cunanan intended to keep him alive for a long while. Because of this, the FBI was willing to say that Cunanan and Lee must have known each other prior to the attack, although there is no direct evidence to this day that this was the case.
Because it sounds like a crime of passion, or at least, you know, something a little bit more personal than, like, a break-in, and I just need your money and your car, or whatever.
Right. If you just wanted the money and the car, you could have just killed the man, or maybe even not killed the man. Could have just taken it.
Yeah.
He's 72. He was a spry 72. But he was 72 years old.
Mm-hmm.
His family also denies that they ever knew Lee to be gay or be intimate with another man or any of that others that had anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
On May 4th, Cunanan would stab Lee repeatedly with a screwdriver 22 times before his throat was ultimately slit using a hacksaw. That is brutal.
That's overkill.
Once friends and family were concerned about not hearing from Lee Miglin, they went looking on Lee's property. Eventually, they would find his body in his own garage.
That's, like, just pure rage.
Yeah. But, I mean, again, this man was clearly very well-loved if people were missing him after just hours, essentially. Yeah. I would say less than 24 hours. Lee's green Lexus was missing, but just down the road, a red Jeep registered to David. 5 days after Lee's body was found, 45-year-old William Bill Reese was out work at Fens Point National in Pennsville Township, New Jersey.
And he got far.
Yeah. So he was gone from Minneapolis. He went up to Minnesota a little bit. Or not Minnesota, but Lake.
Yeah.
The lake, which was 3 hours away. Then drove to Chicago.
Yeah.
In the opposite direction. Then we were at... Now we're at Jersey.
The farthest point from California.
Yeah. So we're talking about Bill Reese. Bill loved his wife, his job, which he had worked for over 15 years, and enjoyed Civil War reenactments with friends, which is
that's so wholesome.
Adorable. So cute. He was described as a kind man, and he had a real love for life and laughs. But once again, Cunanan needed to switch vehicles after learning that the FBI had been tracking Lee's car by pinging the car's phone as Cunanan was using it. Which, again, we have to remind the listeners that this is in the 90s.
Right. It's not like...
You had car phones.
Knowledgeable. Okay? Like, I mean, he might not even realize it could be tracked.
Right. Exactly. I mean, this was... You had a landline at home or you had a car phone.
Yeah.
I mean, that was as mobile, pun intended, as phones got.
Yeah.
So, yes, they could track this while Cunanan was driving because he insisted on using it.
They call it and he's like, hello, what do you want?
He must have thought he was real rich shit.
Yeah.
Sitting in that Lexus with that phone car.
Probably.
I'm sure he drove with the windows rolled down so everybody could see him using it. Mm. While driving through the cemetery, Cunanan, he saw Bill's 95 red Chevy pickup sitting outside the caretaker's office. Cunanan would enter the office, find Bill, where he would shoot him in the head, and Bill would essentially die almost instantly. But again, he didn't torture him.
Yeah.
What's the difference between him and Lee?
I don't know. And also, what's the difference between giving me your keys at gunpoint and killing the man?
Yeah.
Like, he just wanted to kill, seems like. And I think that, the difference might be the time that had passed from David's murder.
Mm-hmm.
So my mind, you know, psychologically standpoint speaking, is he's raging, even though he's multiple hours away from Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
That whole drive, he's probably hitting the steering wheel in a rage.
Yeah.
First person he sees, overkill, brutal murder.
Mm-hmm.
Then he has all this time to drive to New Jersey. Maybe some of that has worn off.
Yeah.
But he still thinks that he has to cover his track, so to speak, so he kills the man quickly.
I think what's interesting about it, too, is that the time in between is getting shorter. You had David, where he killed Jeffrey.
Mm-hmm.
He had David with him for, 3 days?
Yeah, almost.
Then he tortures Lee for 18 hours. Then he just shot Bill.
Mm-hmm.
So is it that he's feeling the pressure?
Yeah.
He's feeling the anxiety. He knows he's going to get caught soon. So it's becoming more of a spree.
Yeah. Well, he knows he's being tracked.
Yeah. Andrew Cunanan would steal Bill's truck, leaving Bill in the office with the radio playing. It wasn't until Bill did not return home by dinner time that Bill's wife arrived at the cemetery to check on him.
Oh my God.
She would be the one to find Bill's body. Cunanan continued to head south, perhaps to find somewhere low-key. However, it's never been in Andrew's nature to remain low-key.
Right, he's always wanted to be, like, a peacock.
Mm-hmm. Andrew Cunanan books a hotel in the Normandy Plaza Hotel on May 12th in Miami, Florida, for $20 a night.
Whoa.
Sorry, $29 a night.
Hey, big spender. But in the 90s.
I did the conversion. It's still, only, $80.
Still, though, motel's, 40 right now, so.
Well, that's true. It's not the most lavish hotel, but it does boast that some of the world's most famous players have stayed there, including Marilyn Monroe, Humphrey Bogart, and Frank Sinatra.
Ooh. He's like, I've made it.
I would say that it's stupid for Andrew to go to a major city. However, he chooses this location specifically for its nightlife. This is in South Beach, Miami, where there is a dense gay population. And Andrew Cunanan could fit right in, hiding in plain sight.
Perhaps blend in, even.
Perhaps even blend in. Just gonna become one of the locals.
Yeah, he's gonna fake a Cuban accent.
1 month after Bill Reese's murder, Andrew Cunanan was officially added to the FBI's most wanted list.
Oh my god, it's been a month already.
A month since his last killing.
And
that we know of.
And he's just hanging around people. People are interacting with him every single day.
Every single day.
Probably sleeping with more wealthy men.
Yeah.
Probably using their money.
Yeah, he's going back to his old life. Whether it's your favorite browser or by app, listening to audiobooks with Audiobooks Now makes it easier and more affordable to enjoy your favorite books. Audiobooks Now subscribers receive their club price plan and includes other amazing deals. Click the link in the show notes for an exclusive offer today. Get audiobooks you love for less with Audiobooks Now. So yes, the FBI had added him to the most wanted list after bullet fragments found at the scene were matched to the bullet fragments at the David Madsen murder. This is Bill's murder. So same gun, same bullet. But even this would not keep Cunanan from walking along Miami's South Beach every night.
Gun in hand.
Gun in hand.
No, that's horrible. But that's just, like, the arrogance is what it is. Yeah. It's like, oh, I'm just going to do whatever the fuck I want again, and no one can catch me.
Yeah, I'm sure he thought, like, okay, well, I'll go out this day, and if nobody recognizes me, then I'll go out the next day, and the next day, until, you know, somebody gives him a side eye.
He's like, ooh, I got away with it.
Yeah. On July 7th, Cunanan, low on funds, takes a gold coin previously stolen from Lee Miglin's residence.
Idiot.
And walks into a pawn shop. He then pawns the coin for just $200. The clerk of the shop only asked for Andrew's full name and current residence. With Cunanan feeling completely unbeatable at this point, gives his real name and the address of the Normandy Motel where he's staying.
Wow. Room number...
yeah, right?
I'm there from the hours of...
I also murdered three people. Yeah. So write that down.
And a month ago.
Yeah. The clerk did not ask Andrew Cunanan for any forms of identification, simply taking his word for it. Nonetheless, the paperwork was filed, eventually ending up on the desk of Miami's police department, which checks all pawn records for things like stolen goods and guns and stuff. Yeah. This paperwork, however, would not immediately be looked at. Cunanan would make this money last for just one more week. Okay, what I'm thinking is, you're running a hotel for what? $30 a night? I mean, I guess that's enough, right? Yeah, I think that's about a week. But still, you know, he's going out still.
Yeah.
I mean, he can't help it.
But again, he's probably getting everything paid for him when he goes out because he's charming.
That's true. So Cunanan would eventually have to check out of the hotel on July 14th, 1997. You were 2 years old.
It was two.
The very next morning, a set of circumstances would ensure that the entire world would know the name Andrew Cunanan, and even more so, the name Gianni Versace. Giovanni Versace was born on the 2nd of December, 1946, to his parents, his mother being a dressmaker by trade.
Oh.
Which is adorable.
Yeah.
Gianni was the middle child of four. One of his siblings had actually passed away at age 12 by an untreated illness, so he would have had three siblings. I'm sorry. Oh, no. He has four. One passed away. There's two remaining. Growing up, he had an older brother, Santo, and a younger sister named Donatella. Gianni grew up embracing his culture as the family lived in the... Oh, gosh, just bear with me. It's Reggio Calabria.
There you go.
Known for its dense Greek and Italian influences. At a young age, Gianni was helping his mother in her dressmaking, and he had always had a keen eye for design. At first, he thought he'd become an architect, but found that he did have a true gift in fashion. At age 26, he moved to Milan to pursue his career in fashion. He first collaborated with the design company Jenny for his youth and junior line, Biblos. And then he moved to another collab titled Complice. And soon in 1978, Gianni would introduce his first collection and would open a boutique before his first fashion show in Milan.
How cool.
I know, right? He's like mid-20s.
Yeah, I don't have an eye for that kind of thing.
Ugh, wild. Gianni was known for his bold use of color and pushing the boundaries of sexuality. Gianni was used to sewing women's wear and thus often tailored men's suits with stitching that accentuated the male form.
Wow.
Right? So that's why it was so unique and why it was so revolutionary. It was that he was not designing women's wear, he was designing men's wear, but that
shape form.
That shaped the male body.
That's really cool. I didn't know that. And especially for that time period, there's plenty of people, men, that like to dress differently. Like, not, and you know, so many men's clothing that you see today is all the same cut, the same fit, except for, like, big and tall.
Right.
You know, they're most usually the same style and the same fit, and that's really cool that it was super unique, and no wonder he's so famous.
Essentially, Gianni laid the form for, or the platform down for things like slim fit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Skinny jeans, if you think about it. You know, things like that. Little influences.
We are skinny jeans gals through and through.
Oh my god.
I cannot get away from the skinny jeans. Oh my gosh. Although I have bought some Carpenter jeans recently, and I don't hate them.
So Gianni actually would design and make his own materials and fabrics.
Wow.
Like, he's actually named specific fabrics, blends of fabrics.
Cool.
Yeah, I mean, he's like,
he's a genius.
He's the godfather.
Creative genius.
Gianni would add nodes to his Greek heritage by incorporating gods and goddesses on his designs, one of the more famous one being that of Medusa. Gianni had rivalries at the time, especially with fashion designer Giorgio Armani, saying that, quote, "Armani dresses the wife, but Versace dresses the mistress," end quote.
Ooh, scandaloso.
Gianni created his business around his family. His brother Santo was the president, and his sister Donatella was the vice president, making her husband overseer of menswear. So it was a whole family affair.
That's honestly really cool, too, because he provided for them as well, not just for himself. He's like, hey, like, I want to bring you guys in on this. Like, this is really cool.
It's an empire.
Yeah, definitely.
In 1982, Gianni would meet the man that would change his life forever.
Mm.
Model Antonio D'Amico. It was said that Gianni and Antonio loved each other very much and traveled and worked together most of their life together. It was when the two had traveled to Miami for work when Gianni told Antonio that he would never want to leave. He loved the excitement, the heat, the culture, and the scene of South Beach. Gianni would purchase an oceanfront property at the time worth under just $3 million, which was a lot. So the property was dubbed Casina Casuarina, which was located on South Beach in 1992, where the couple would eventually live permanently. Gianni Versace bought the house for $2.95 million in 1992. He would restore the original name and actually return it to private use because it had been, I think, turned into a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
He created 8 bedrooms, 2 kitchens, 3 sitting rooms, 10 bathrooms, a bar, a library, and 4 living rooms.
Goals.
Right? He installed modern systems, including central air conditioning. And in 1993, Versace bought the adjoining Riviera Hotel to the south for $3.7
million. Jeez.
Which he would then tear down to make a pool and a garden area for the house. Could you imagine buying a $3 million house just to tear it down?
That is baller.
It's amazing.
That is fucking baller.
Whoa. The pool was known as the renowned Thousand Mosaic Pool, adorned with thousands of 24-karat gold tiles imported from Italy.
Jeez, doing the damn thing.
Versace had actually commissioned Sir Roy Strong, which is an English art historian and landscape designer, to work on the garden, to create the garden. He had also created gardens at Versace's Villa Fortunelli on Lake Como in Italy. And Gianni loved this place, and the locals loved him, too. He would sometimes walk down to the South Beach streets, and often wouldn't be hassled as much. One of his daily tasks would be collect the newest magazines, and regularly he had an assistant do this for him most mornings. On the morning of July 15th, however, Gianni wanted to make the morning walk alone at about 8:45 in the morning. Gianni reached the cafe for the daily articles, purchased a newspaper, and then began to make the walk back. When Gianni reached the gate of his home, he would be shot twice in his back as his back was turned to an assailant.
What? How did I not know this?
It's pretty intense. Witnesses who looked into the direction of the shots said that a man dressed in a gray t-shirt, black shorts, a white hat, and carrying a backpack was fleeing the scene by the time that they saw what was going on. Antonio, inside the mansion, heard something outside, and he could see through the stained glass upstairs that there was a commotion. But not truly being able to see, he ran downstairs and would open the gates, where he saw his partner of 15 years laying in a pool of blood on the front steps of their home.
Oh my God, how scary.
Antonio said about this moment, quote, "I saw Gianni lying on the steps with blood around him. At that point, everything went dark. I was pulled away. I didn't see anymore," end quote. Paramedics arrived on scene where they took Gianni Versace to the hospital, where he would later be pronounced dead, just 40 minutes after the shots.
Okay, this is literally another John Lennon story, because I did not know that he was dead.
Yeah.
I swear I thought this guy was alive.
The company's still, yeah.
Yeah. Around. Oh my God, how horrible.
Meanwhile, police scoured the area looking for clues on who this gunman might be. There, in a nearby parking garage, was Bill Reese's 1995 Chevy truck.
Damn.
Around it, articles of clothing that matched the description that the witnesses gave.
So he changed.
Or he just took his clothes off, I don't know.
Just run around naked. They're not looking for a naked guy.
He's naked somewhere. They realize now that Cunanan was in Miami. Other witnesses stated that Cunanan had hopped into a taxi before fleeing the scene. Hearing this, police declared an immediate shutdown of the city.
Yeah.
Of Miami.
That's a huge, hugely famous person that just got assassinated.
Residents were encouraged to stay in place, lock their doors, and stay off the streets while police search for Cunanan.
Right. And they knew it was him. Oh, because of the car.
Yeah. Cunanan would not be seen for another 8 days.
So scary.
Like, what do you do? When do you lift the stay in place?
I wouldn't leave my house.
What? No, right? Thank you. The homeboy's just running around naked somewhere. What are you gonna do?
That's so bad.
A caretaker on an Ocean Drive marina was inspecting houseboats one by one, making sure that all was secure and good. But something caught his eye. Inside one of the houseboats, Andrew Cunanan had sought refuge, a mere 7 minutes away from Versace's mansion.
He had been there the whole time.
For 8 days.
Oh my God.
When the caretaker shouted to alert the man that he was trespassing, a shot was fired. Frightened of being killed, the caretaker ran to phone the police on his findings. The police immediately thinking this must be Cunanan. Police respond to the call and quickly surround the houseboat, ordering Cunanan to come out with his hands in the air and surrender to law enforcement.
This reminds me so much of the Boston Marathon bomber guy, the way it played out.
Oh my gosh, I remember watching that on the news.
He was literally hiding in a boat, like on someone's property. Yeah.
But I mean, I remember seeing those like aerial shots with the helicopters, and there was like blood smearing on the sides of the boats because he had been shot.
Yeah.
We have to cover that one.
We definitely do.
It's intense. So after a long standoff, police decided to enter the houseboat in order to forcefully remove Cunanan. There in the houseboat, lying on the bed, was Andrew Cunanan. He had taken his own life by a single gunshot to the head. He had used the very same gun he used throughout the entire killing spree. So, initially, the houseboat guy, when he shouted and he heard a fire, he thought that he was being fired upon, but it was actually Andrew Cunanan taking his own life.
Honestly, that kind of peeves me.
Doesn't it all? A spree killing, right, is defined by the Death Investigation Training Academy as, quote, a spree killing involving a string of at least 3 murders in several locations, arising from a key participating incident that continues to fuel the motivation to kill. In this case, Cunanan's apparent hatred for gay men.
Mm-hmm.
The murders occur fairly close in time, but the time frame lasts significantly longer than that of a mass murder, and locations are further apart. The victims can be targeted or random, end quote. It was also insinuated that Andrew Cunanan was a sociopath being a person with a personality disorder manifesting itself in extreme antisocial attitudes and behaviors and lack of conscious. So what we say when oftentimes we come across that word, sociopath or psychopath, it's due to a personality disorder. That is the diagnosis, mm-hmm. not one or the other.
It's tendencies that put them into those categories.
Yes. Which we now know, again, could potentially be antisocial personality disorder in Andrew Cunanan's case, but
the world may never know. Or narcissistic personality disorder.
Yeah. Andrew Cunanan's true motives have never been revealed, as that knowledge died with him. But what we can say is that Andrew Cunanan clearly struggled with his place in the world. The lifestyle he wanted to live was unattainable by conventional matters, as he wasn't essentially going to work hard for it. He was just going to take it. He was too rebellious and self-centered enough to share deep connections with others, which we talk about narcissistic tendencies, right? Mm-hmm. They're kind of apparent. Or was he just angry? After Gianni's death, his sister Donatella took over the family design. While some thought that she would never live up to her brother's work, Donatella has proven to strengthen the family's name and has created a complete empire in the Versace name.
Ooh, I got full body heat.
I know. Donatella and Antonio had it out a bit after Gianni's death, as Donatella had the majority of Gianni's estate, and Antonio would essentially have to fight for his right as Gianni's partner. Again, mm-hmm. this is before yeah. same-sex marriage was legal, and, you know, that's part of the reason why I think it should have always been legal. Mm-hmm. It's for situations like this.
Right.
Where you spent 15 years with your partner and you have no legal rights to anything you accumulated over the time you were together. Because you weren't married.
Yep.
Like it was a choice. Sad. So yes, it was ruled that Antonio could stay in Gianni's other residence with certain restrictions. And in 2018, a miniseries titled The Assassination of Gianni Versace, American Crime Story, was released on FX. The show received both praise and scrutiny for the portrayal of Gianni and his partner, even by Antonio. Quote, there's been so much written and said about the murder and thousands of suppositions, but not a trace of reality, end quote. Antonio expressed concern that the actor who portrayed him, which was Ricky Martin,
oh my God,
did not reach out to him in order to get a deeper understanding of the relationship between him and Gianni.
Which you assumed.
Think that that would be part of your job.
Yeah.
If you're portraying a real person, at least, you know, Antonio would have the choice of saying, you can talk to a source or you can talk to me personally.
Right.
But to not even reach out.
That's silly.
Come on, Ricky Martin, do better.
You're living La Vida Loca for sure. Sorry. Woke up in New York City in a funky cheap motel. All right, I'm done.
He's talking about Andrew Cunanan.
Oh my God.
Antonio said, quote, the picture of Ricky Martin holding the body in his arms is ridiculous. Maybe it's the director's poetic license, but that is not how I reacted, end quote. Antonio would describe the clip of the show that he found Gianni as looking like the famous statue La Pietà de Michelangelo.
Yeah, which with the stab wound in the side.
Yeah, it's which like, is Mary holding Jesus in her yeah. arms. And that's the way it was supposed to look. But if you think about Gianni, maybe he might have been a religious person, but if you're really going to duplicate a piece of art, don't you think that it would emulate something like Greek gods and goddesses?
Right.
Or Italian influences. And I get like Michelangelo is Italian, mm-hmm. but you know,
something
it's just
a little more up their alley.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just seems like low-hanging fruit.
Or, you know, just ask the person that's still around to tell you.
Right.
It's the courtesy you can do.
Exactly.
That's gotta be hard to see a documentary portrayed not only about your person's life, but your life as well.
Yeah.
And not be able to give any help for facts.
Think about the most traumatic thing that's ever happened to you. And now think about Hollywood making it into something.
Yeah.
And not even asking you what it was like.
Yeah.
That's what that's like. It's awful. Unfortunately, Antonio would pass away in December 2022 at the age of 63, aww, which is so young.
That is really young.
But as far as I can tell, I don't think he ever married. Yeah. I think he dated long term, but yeah. Aww. Well, Andrew Cunanan does not deserve final notes. Only Gianni Versace does, so.
Yeah. That's intense. That is
Andrew Cunanan.
I am baffled over here. I thought that Gianni Versace was alive. I'm silly. I need to get up on my pop culture, I guess.
Your fashionistas.
Yeah. But that story just from start to finish is wild. And, you know, we had kind of peppered in a couple of suggestions for disorders, but I think it has a lot of, you know, and we always say that it has to do with like a, you know, poor childhood, low self-esteem, things like that happen when you're younger.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that his dad, not only not being around for the majority of his childhood, but then up and leaving at the drop of a hat,
abandoning
really,
him.
Really affected him.
Yeah.
And of course, he not only had to endure maybe that verbal, any kind of abuse that he did, but he had to watch his mom go through that as well, and maybe his siblings, and that's traumatic in itself, and all those things can cause a dissociation of reality later in life, which is really true for people with antisocial personality disorder.
I'm wondering if there wasn't something underlying originally, right? Like you said, antisocial personality disorder. But there's this just overall aura of defiance around Andrew. And did it start out as a defiance disorder?
Yeah.
And did it not get treated or seen at all?
Or maybe it got stifled.
Yeah. And of course, he had Liz, and for a short time there, he had Jeffrey, that were validating those feelings, being some of the only people that he probably felt validated in to his core.
Right.
Other than that, it seems like a lot of bouncing around to different, I would say, social groups to get that validation.
It also seems like, you know, Liz and Jeffrey were what they could be for him for as long as they could be, but at a certain time comes in your life where you mentally develop and you grow up, and it almost seems like they kind of kept growing with their emotional maturity, and Andrew didn't.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what caused that disconnect between them, and that's obviously got to be another thing. I feel like maybe there was an emotional stunt in his brain, and that's what kept him from becoming, you know, a mature, functioning, emotional, functioning adult.
I'm sure he always wanted...
having all that rage develop because of it.
Yeah, having to, you know, deal with this Peter Pan syndrome, if you will.
Yeah.
And wanting to remain young and hot.
And taken care of.
Always. I mean, you know, like, you hit the nail on the head right there, because that's what I see. I see him not having that childhood enough for longer, right? Mm-hmm. He had to grow up very, very fast. I mean, he was going down, you know, to these very potentially seedy areas, even in high school, trying to stay taken care of.
Yeah.
You know?
Financially and emotionally and all that stuff. And when you have someone else taking care of all those things for you, then it gives you an excuse to not do it yourself. Again, like emotionally mature.
Yeah. He didn't want to grow up.
Right. But that's a wild story. Thank you for bringing that. I did not know that case at all. I had said that the last name just sounds kind of familiar, but nope, did not know it. So thanks for bringing that.
And you're welcome.
I hope you guys enjoyed this one.
Yeah. I'm excited to never talk about Andrew Cunanan ever again.
Perfect.
I can go to bed easy now, not have to have nightmares.
Just a quick reminder, we do have that new Patreon set up. There are still technically 4 tiers open. You can join any one of the 3 that are $5. They're all still there. And then the first one is $3. So the $3 one is going to get you those ad-free episodes. The $5 will get you ad-free episodes as well as the bonus episode every month. Takes just a couple minutes to sign up. And yeah, that's pretty much all we got.
Yeah.
Anything else? Right.
That's it.
Okay, we'll see you guys soon.
Love you.
Love you.
Bye. Bye.
Loving a pet is easy. Losing a pet is hard. Perfect Memorials has been chosen by families since 2001 for their unique memorial products. Choosing a cremation urn or other product from Perfect Memorials allows many special ways to memorialize your loved one. Keep your furry friend in your memory forever with unique, handcrafted, and personalized products for everyone. Click the link in our show notes for an exclusive offer with Perfect Memorials today.